Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Welcome to the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show on the Voice of Vachon, located on the beautiful Vachon Island in the heart of the Salish Sea between Seattle and Tacoma in the state of Washington. That was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Brian started the Briefly and brought his high standard of intelligent discussion current events laced with humor and empathy, which we try to duplicate. Brian's motto was, less is more, more or less, and he always offered much, much more. Our Briefly panel includes our big board pilot, real life pilot, treetop flyer, an almost fully reformed Texan, Truman O'Brien.
I love that almost fully reformed.
Well, Vachon does what it can, but it can't do everything.
That's true.
Right?
That is true. Yeah. You've done a fine job so far. Thank you.
Also, Legal Eagle, consensus builder, former Washington State Assistant Attorney General, a ladies' shoe salesman, which is a whole story in and of itself that we need to dive in perhaps next week when we have the Truman Show, and Fulbright, not half-bright scholar, Craig Bellis.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you here. We also have our avid defender of justice, mariner, cyclist, and top secret engineer joining us from Genoa Bay via Zoom, Kevin Jones. So, Kevin, tell us where Genoa Bay is.
Well, great to join you, of course, and hopefully the audio on this Wi-Fi is coming through okay, so give me a thumbs up. Okay, looks like you can hear fine. Genoa Bay is on Vancouver Island, and it is on the south end of the island, just north of the municipality of Cowichan. And so if you remember those Cowichan sweaters and hats, that's just where they're just right around the corner. And so if you're thinking about where would I get to Genoa Bay, say from a place I know like Victoria, what you would do is drive north on, I think it's Highway 1, over the, what's the name of the pass? You basically have to head west and then north up island. And once you get over the pass, it's pretty much the first settlement that you run into is Cowichan. Mm-hmm. And then just north of there is Genoa Bay.
Ah, my recollection of Cowichan is it's filled with murals, historic murals. Is that correct?
You might be thinking of Chemainus.
Oh, Chemainus. All right.
Mm-hmm. Ah. Yeah,
Cowichan. Memory lapse.
Cowichan is a spectacular little village built sort of on top of each other along the water. I suspect that it started as a waterfront community before they had access inland, much like some of the places on Vachon. And so it's sort of a hodgepodge of marinas and shops and restaurants. And I actually met a fellow there who's working for the municipality of Cowichan. Was born in the middle of Canada and decided he wanted to see water more often, and so he's now in a waterfront community. So it's great to have a chance to see how things are doing here in this part of rural Canada.
While we got you talking, how's the cruise going so far? Boat operating properly? Anchor going up and down and all that good stuff?
Well, you know, after having replaced, with some good fortune, I've been able to replace the motor on the windlass, so I don't have to haul the anchor in by hand. The next thing that required replacement, this is reminding me of Truman's appliance stories. Basically, the main ship's water pump decided to operate in a sort of a weird fashion and ultimately tripped one of the circuit breakers on the boat. which I've learned by chartering a boat years ago that a boat that relies on the circuit breakers to keep from causing a fire is a bad situation. So the good news is when we stocked up the boat years ago to go up to the far reaches of Canada, we supplied all kinds of replacement parts, including the main ship's water pumps. So we're operating on the replacement unit as of about 7 days ago. So it's working really great. But yeah, we've been to, since we've talked on the briefly, we've been to Blind Bay on Shaw Island. We went to Garrison, home of the British camp on San Juan Island during the Pig War. We're in Roach Harbor, that pretty much is a famous resort on the north end of San Juan Island. And we crossed over to Sydney, in a Sydney by the Bay. If you haven't had a chance to go check out Sydney, go to the Beacon Cafe, have a cup of tea, go to the haunted bookstore, go to the Fairview Market in the international section. It's a spectacular spot. Then we run around the corner to Todd Inlet, which is basically embraces Bouchard Gardens. And we were there on the weekend, so we had a chance to see the fireworks from the bay. And then we crossed over here to Genoa.
Sounds like a great cruise to me. Are you going to invite us all along next year?
That's just what I was going to say. Man, oh
yeah,
man.
Right.
Just need a bigger boat.
So also one of the brieflies who is unable to be with us today is our part-time Politico, most-time housing wonk, and full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreyer. So I hope Amy's having a great day. And I'm historian Bruce Holman. Today, for our small talk guest, we have Vashon Heritage Museum's executive director, Greta Simpson.
Hello, happy to be here.
Great to have you here. Now, today, before we jump into the show and talking to Greta, let's check in with everybody about what special things went on this week, this past week, including the 4th of July, of course. So, Truman, how about you?
Well, I had a pretty quiet 4th. We didn't go out, which is unusual for us. We usually go and hit the fireworks, but this year we just felt like, let's just take it easy at home. But hey, I did go over to my nephew's place in Port Orchard the day before the 4th. His cousin from Montana was out visiting. A very long story of who she is, but her mother and I were very close for a number of years. The whole family were great friends. And anyway, it was great getting to visit with her a little bit. And I had never met her. Well, I met her husband once, but get a chance to get to know him. It was just a blast. Anyway, so pretty quiet week for me.
Sounds good. Quiet is always good,
you
correct?
Bet. You bet.
So, Craig, how about you?
Well, after I heard Kevin's rendition of his past week, I think I sat in my gravel driveway and threw gravel up in the air over my head because I wasn't along for the ride. No, seriously, I had a fun show. My first Thursday morning scramble show last week was a trifecta. It started out with a tribute to Jim Morrison and the Doors, because Jim Morrison died on that day, July 3rd. The Doors being one of my favorite groups. I saw them back in 1967 at UC Santa Barbara. Quite a show. And then I covered the Newport Jazz, the first day of the Newport Jazz Festival. That was the first Newport Jazz Festival in 1969 that let rock and roll into the festival.
Is that the one that Janis Joplin?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, no.
Okay.
Janis was, I think, the next
was
one,
it the
if
next
I recall.
One? Okay.
Because this was just before Woodstock.
Oh, right.
And then I did the third part of the show was the Atlanta Pop Festival, and that was right after Woodstock. Right. And some estimates had upwards of 600,000 people. Whoa. at that particular, and they say that it was bigger than Woodstock. Jimi Hendrix, they say that was the biggest audience he ever played in front of, and that was the last time that they had a pop festival or almost any major festival in the state of Georgia. Lester Maddox decided they The folks there didn't like that kind of long-haired hippie
like
stuff.
There.
That's right. We're not going to have any more of them, their things. Then this last Friday went to the fireworks down at the Yacht Harbor, and quite the show. Stayed on a boat with a neighbor of mine who's right at the very end of all of the mm-hmm. the boats and has a clear view of the perfect. Fireworks. It was perfect. And Bruce lent me his special parking place. At least I saw his name. A big poster said Bruce said Bruce Holman. I couldn't read the rest of it. And so I parked right in front of that. And it was
appropriate.
it was a good week to say the least. And the weather was unbelievable.
And it still is.
Yeah, it is.
Thank goodness. Yeah. Summer has arrived before the 4th of
That's
July
right,
this year.
Change, which, yeah. That yeah. is global warming in action.
Exactly. So, Greta, how about you? How was your week?
Oh, yeah. Lovely. We dedicated the Hydro Boathouse over the Roger Stanley Hydro Boathouse. And that was very fun, really good turnout. And so it had everybody really excited about the hydros. And I went for the first time the next morning with my husband and my daughter, and she saw the first boat come, she saw the winning boat come in, and she pointed at it and she said, "I love that one."
how old is your daughter?
She's three.
Three, oh, all right.
Wow. What color was it?
I can't remember.
I think that was Mattingly's boat.
Okay.
I think it's the red one, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the red one. That sounds right. Oh, and she likes a fast moving thing.
She's a fast liver, right? Uh-huh. And most three-year-olds are. Uh-huh.
I have to tell you, when my daughter was three, I think I've told this before, but we flew down to St. Helens when it was erupting on May 18th the first time, and we're pointing out the eruption to Molly. She couldn't tell what was what, and she looked at the wingtip. When they had tip tanks, and she was like, "Ooh, wow, that wingtip is really cool." So, yeah, I'm impressed that your daughter liked the boat. You know?
we dropped by the museum for that. That's a beautiful little setup that you've got back there.
Oh yeah, it's really fun, and it's been such a labor of love. You know, Brian Breno curated, mm-hmm. and a lot of volunteers and support, and it looks really nice. Mm-hmm. That garden area, especially this time of year, is mm-hmm. just spectacular. Everyone should go on a picnic out there
and see a really cool little hydro that's parked there.
Yep. So Kevin, you've told us a bit about what you've been doing, so any other things to add? I did have one question: is why did Bouchard Gardens have fireworks on the 4th of July?
They had fireworks on Saturday.
Oh, they cheated, huh?
So it's every Saturday, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mind sort of trying to figure out, okay, are they celebrating the 4th of July for us?
Well, Canada Day was
July 1st.
Yeah, it was right there. Right.
Yeah, we came into Sydney on Canada Day, and one of the really fun things that they did out in the park, right at the foot of Beacon Avenue, which is where the beacon was, where mm-hmm. they would light the fire back in the, you know, square rig ship days, so the ships could find their way to Sydney. Mm-hmm. At any rate, at the foot of Beacon Avenue is a fairly nice little beach, glass beach. And they had a deal there where you could arrive, and they had a building materials company. You could build your own boat.
Oh.
And then you would launch them into the water, and it was a race. And they would go basically around a couple of buoys, and it was hilarious to see, you know, who made it, who didn't, and how many boats flipped, which was, you know, about a third of them, topsy-turvy. So that's how we spent Canada Day. And then we were wondering if the Canadians would recognize the 4th of July given our current political situation. And no, they didn't. We're not totally surprised by that. On Vashon, on 4th of July, the Indivisible Vashon protest group with the drum corps, I understand, I wasn't there, but there was also an accompanying flautist, or maybe more. You watch the Beachcomber because Liz is going to put together an article. There were over 100 people there. There was a singing of America the Beautiful. The Declaration of Independence was read. Greg Wessel was there in a Continental Army, dressed up as a Continental Army enlistee, and an updated Declaration of Independence was read. So that was something notable that I wanted to pass on. So thanks to everybody who organized and arranged that, and for Liz, of course, for covering that in the paper. Let's see, we're here in Genoa Bay Marina, the number one marina in Genoa Bay for the last 72 years. So I thought that was pretty impressive. So if you look around, you'll see it's the only one here. And yesterday I apologize to all Canadians for doing this. I did hike up to the top of Zuhalem Mountain, which is basically rises up above Genoa Bay on the Mad Dog route, which is a pretty lot of vertical sections there. And unfortunately, I fed at the latest count about 127 mosquitoes. So sorry. I tried to, you know, eliminate as many as I fed, but I think the feeders outnumbered the deceased.
So you didn't plant a flag on top, an American flag, did you?
I did not.
Okay, good.
It's actually covered with mountain bike trails.
Oh.
In fact, yeah. So it's a well-worn and great recreational site for mountain bikers and hikers.
Sounds like a great week. So for me, you know, 4th of July, of course, took the grandkids down to watch from the harbor. And for the four-year-old, August, it was his first time seeing big fireworks. And he was pumped. He was excited. In fact, when he got home about 11 o'clock, I talked to his mom and dad were saying he was so wired he couldn't go to sleep. So he was up for another couple hours, you know, just sort of like still sort of zooming on those fireworks. It was pretty amazing. But we had the 7 and 11 year old as well, and they just, it's exciting to be around kids when fireworks are going off. They just sort of like oohing and aahing. And it's just, I feel as we get older, we get a bit jaded for that kind of stuff. Maybe. But it was one of the most spectacular displays I've seen in the harbor. And the finale was just incredible. It went on for 5 minutes or so. It was just pretty spectacular. And then, of course, crab season opened on Sunday. And so brought the crab boat around to Ellisport and crabbed off of KVI Beach. And we did pretty well. We did, in fact, on Sunday, the very first pot we pulled had probably a dozen big Dungeness crab in it. And, and there were only my son and I, so we could only get 10 of them. So we were throwing Dungeness back, and I'm thinking, oh, God, this hurts so badly to throw them back. And actually, you know, we also got a number of Red Rock, and we just, you know, Why eat Red Rock when you can have Dungeness? And later in the season, you know, they'll be much more attractive. But it looks like it's going to be a great crab season. So, and crab season is open every Sunday and Monday, you know, from sunrise on Sunday till sunset on Monday through September 1st. So there's about, 7-8 sort of weeks of crabbing left. So it should be good.
I'm waiting for the fireworks. I kind of like the fireworks. I grew up in an area that, you know, that was one of the big deals. Mm-hmm. But I'm waiting for the full drone display, which are unbelievable.
They're incredible.
They are absolutely unbelievable. You throw all these drones together, maybe throw some lasers in there as well, and it is just one incredible show. And it's so much easier, of course, on the animals, having had dogs and cats and horses all the time we've lived on the island. And then there are plenty of veterans who have issues with the with the fireworks. So, you know, it'd still be a spectacular show.
I think it's the way of the future.
Yep.
definitely. Yeah.
I like the idea of the electrification of fireworks. That's an awesome idea, Craig.
Slobin, welcome to the 19th century.
Yes, yes. My climate activism ears are perking up on that.
Well, it sounds like everybody's had a great week, and many more to come this summer. It looks like it's going to be a spectacular summer, although it is dry. Oh, it's really dry.
65% chance for rain tomorrow.
We pray for that.
But then nothing but heat after that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the driest summers I remember on Vashon. I mean, this is what you get usually in late August, early September.
You know, and so, as you know, as our island historian, fires are not something that we're exempt from on this island.
No, been lots of fires in the past. And, you know, we've lived through a 20-25 year period where we haven't had many big fires. But this summer it's going to be interesting.
It was scary there for a moment. I don't know if you noticed it, but there were some people along the shore that were shooting off flares.
Right. Mm.
That were drifting into the trees, and I thought, "Oh man, that's not bright."
Good. That's like about, maybe 8-10 years ago, people launched these fire balloons.
And they drifted.
No. They went out. They were beautiful, but then they drifted north over the island and actually came down, burned a barn. Up at the head of Monument Road. So you got to be careful with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
But we're in for a dry summer, so be careful with fires, for sure. Today, July 8th, is a significant day, as is every day. But today, very appropriately, is National Radio Day. So here we are on the radio celebrating National Radio Day. Did you know it was National Radio Day, Truman?
I did not, and I'm thrilled to know that because, well, as Craig has pointed out in the past, we are really unique. You know, in the world of radio, what we do here is really spectacular, and I'm really proud to be a part of it. It's exciting.
We are the envy of many, many radio stations around the United States. Because we're not corporate. We're not because we're such great DJs and producers, but we don't have that corporate feel, you know.
Yes, right. Yeah, the profit line is not quite what CBS is,
exactly.
Right?
That's right.
So also today is National Raspberry Day, very appropriately.
Which raspberries? The one you give one another or the ones that you
that
eat?
One or the,
No.
Okay.
The kind you get at Sun Isle Farms on Maury. Okay. They're delicious. It's also National Chocolate with Almonds Day, one of my favorite days.
Very specific.
And nobody brought any in. No. That was a mistake.
I hoard it.
Should have hit up C's or something. Yeah.
And it's also National Cow Appreciation Day. Craig, you would appreciate that.
I do, because my daughter is a big fan of cows since a very early age. She loves cows, and we used to take our cross-country camping trips, and she would. And she, though, has made the distinction between a cow and a high-caliber cow, which is a bison.
I grew up on a farm and a ranch, and when I was about 10, I think, my father actually lost his mind and put in a dairy, and one of the calves, I ended up raising that calf, and he and I would play hide and seek, honestly, and he would really do it.
Really?
Tell him, you'd say, go hide, and he would go off and, you know, he'd look at like, what, and then he would take off. And he would be back in a stall somewhere, and I would be walking around going, where's Bully? Where's Bully? And he would just get all excited, and I'd come around the corner, and he would buck and jump and run out of the stall. It was just fascinating.
Did you reverse roles?
Yeah. I would go hide.
And
I'd tell him to wait.
Was he good at
finding? Yes, yes. And I would hide, really hide, and he would be looking and look. I never forgot that.
That's wonderful.
Isn't that wild?
That's wonderful.
Incredible. That is incredible.
Yep.
Wow.
So I like cows, too, obviously.
So Cow Appreciation Day for Truman.
There we go.
That's right. Today in history, some interesting kinds of things. 1795, the U.S. State Department issued the very first U.S. passport. 1853, Commodore Perry sailed into Tokyo Bay, opening up Japan to the West. 1896, William Jennings Bryan gave his Cross of Gold speech. It was a speech basically in supporting of getting off the gold standard and going to silver as a standard. Because there was so little gold and so much silver, it would essentially depreciate the currency and make it easier for laborers and normal people to buy goods. So it became a fundamental platform of the progressive movement in the late 1890s, early 1900s, to get off the gold standard, which the U.S. really didn't officially do until under Richard Nixon in the 1970s. It's also in 1914, Joe Hill was sentenced to death. Joe Hill was the singing wobbly, and when he was sentenced to death, he said, "Don't waste any time mourning, organize." And in 1959, the very first Americans killed in the American phase of the Vietnam War died. And in 2015, the Washington Redskins had their trademark vacated. So the Indian head sort of trademark of the Washington Redskins was deemed offensive to Native Americans.
We could have a whole show on that, couldn't we?
We could, yes.
I think I've told this before, but, you know, we had a Native American gentleman here on the island, and I asked him what he felt, you know, what's his feelings. Oh, he was going to give me a big rant about it, and I said, well, you know, I found a simple solution. They just need to change their logo. And I showed him this picture, and it was a red potato, the Redskins. And he loved it. He said, oh, my gosh, I have to have that. I've got to tell all my friends. So anyway, they really missed the chance. You know, they could have kept it the Redskins and made them potatoes.
They did.
Yeah.
And now they're what, the Commanders
or something
like that. So, yeah, oh, well, wow. Well, let's get down to the that, real.
You know, that's somewhat here. Prophetic, isn't it? The Commanders is sort of a play on the fact that we have our legislature there.
Yes, right.
But it's a little more powerful term that our current president might really appreciate.
No, yeah. And it's a little bit like Margaret Atwood's novel.
Right.
The Commanders.
Yep.
So let's get down to talking to Greta Simpson and learn about the special exhibit at the Heritage Museum that's titled An Island Revered, Honor and Friendship, the Schwabach and the Sherman Family Collection. So, Greta, just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got to Vashon, and a little bit about your role as an executive director at the museum.
Yeah, sure. So I started as executive director just over a year ago. So I just had that anniversary, which is pretty great. It's been a lot of fun. I grew up in Shoreline and Ballard, but my husband and I moved here from Oakland, California, where we'd been living for, you know, like 10 years, close to. For his job, he got a job as the director at Camp Sealth. And I think it was our first week here when the job at the Heritage Museum opened up. And it was amazing. And I was working remotely for the Computer History Museum, which is in Mountain View. And I applied, and the rest is history. So, that's how I got involved. And it just was meant to be.
Truman, you used to be director at...
Actually, no, I was a superintendent, which means I ran the physical plant. I didn't have anything to do with programming.
With the programming.
Yeah, but I lived at camp. I lived up at Tecapi, which is at the top of the hill there, overlooking the orchard. And I spent 3 years there. I loved it. It was a great place. In fact, my daughter was born while we lived there. So, and we had two dogs there while we were there. And I have to just tell a quick story. One of them was a bloodhound blue tick cross. And he had the most wonderful bay. Oh, it was just fabulous. Beautiful voice. And occasionally he would get out at night and would go running through the woods with that bay. And the camp counselors would all go, "It's Uncle Wigglebottom."
Oh.
He's coming. And of course, he would get closer and closer to the camps, and the kids would all get frightened, and then in would walk Gabe. It was really great fun. Great fun.
A hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So, he would go checking for lunches, you know.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Uncle Wigglebottom.
Oh, well, I couldn't tell you very much except that he's currently our unofficial mayor.
Oh, he's running.
Yeah, well, he ran last year, so yeah, he is that. And you would know more than I would about the lore of Uncle Wigglebottom.
I'm afraid that it's lore is the word there. It's been there since camp started, and I really do not know the history of Uncle Wigglebottom except. There was a cabin there that was old.
Still there.
Is it still there?
Yeah, it's still there.
Oh, my gosh. It was dilapidated 40 years ago.
Yeah.
So it must be in wonderful shape now. But, Uncle Wigglebottom's cabin. And I know the kids are always, you know, in awe of him. But
Cert did a search and rescue thing at Camp South, and the cabin was... prominent in the deal. We didn't find
you didn't find Uncle Wigglebottom.
We didn't find him.
The kids leave letters to him.
Oh yeah.
I think.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you know, I'm interested in how you got into the museum business. If you studied it or if you come up through the ranks. You did mention a moment ago that you worked for a computer-related museum in Mountain View, California. But did you have you worked in other places, or do you have? Did you study museum curation or administration? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I I'd studied archaeology in undergrad at University of Hawaii, and then I went to the University of Leicester to specifically study museums and kind of museum theory and museum management and. Did a bunch of internships and worked at a couple places leading up to here. Most recently, the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. I worked in their collections department. And before that, the Hayward Historical Society, kind of similar to the Vashon Heritage Museum. And then I also had some wonderful internships. I was at the Mary Hill Museum, if you've ever been there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such a fabulous and quirky place. Everybody, if you find yourself out that direction, actually, it's worth a trip. Just go out there just to see the museum. The Stonehenge and the view is incredible. That's a really spectacular place. And I got to work at the Mission Houses Museum in Hawaii in Honolulu as well.
Cool.
And that's a very, very cool place. It's across from Iolani Palace, and it was built by the missionaries that first came to the island, but the real story that it has to tell is about the printing press and literacy in Hawaii. So the Native Hawaiians were so enthusiastic about learning to read and write because they could write down their genealogies that within, I think it was something like less than 20 years after the introduction of the printing press, Hawaii was the second most literate nation on earth after Scotland.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Interesting statistic.
Really, really interesting. And so the museum still does like a lot of Hawaiian language.
That's fascinating.
Also worth a visit if you're in Hawaii.
Yeah. When are we all going?
Yeah.
And I was just going to ask about the Robinson family. Was that prominent in any of your studies?
I don't think so.
They were one of the original. They were one of the original families that missionary families, and they own one of the islands. I mean, they actually own.
Yeah. Was it Molokai before it was
a leper
colony?
Mm. Yeah, it could be.
I don't think that was it either. That sounds familiar.
The only reason I know about it is that we had a pilot at Horizon who was a Robinson, and he was part of that family. So
I'll have to refresh my...
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. Anyway, sorry. Didn't mean to get off track.
So, Kevin, you had a question.
Well, I had a comment. You mentioned the Mary Hill Museum and the Stonehenge. And probably the last time I was there was, I think, around 1978. They had the full solar eclipse. And like that Mary Hill was like right in the center of the path. So we drove out and we're driving up from the Columbia River Gorge and up the road, and the fog is lying in thick in the valley. We're wondering if we're going to see any of the eclipse. As we got toward the top of the hill, the clouds broke, and the people along the road who were lined up, there were people in druid costumes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The full idea of the Stonehenge and Mary Hill and a full eclipse brought out all kinds of amazing characters.
And I believe they still do a solstice celebration every year, too, at the Stonehenge. Cool. Wow. That's very cool.
Not surprising.
Yeah. And they also have some pretty good wine there.
They do. Yes, they do.
You know, I had another question. You mentioned a museum in Hayward.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the history of Tesla?
No.
Oh.
Computer History Museum's research archive was across the street from the Tesla factory.
Oh, wow.
So
that was also a computer related.
No, it wasn't.
Oh, okay.
So the Tesla factory is in Fremont.
It's in Fremont, right.
And the research archive, not the museum, but the research archive of the Computer History Museum was literally across the street from the Tesla factory.
Okay.
So we had a lot of run-ins with Tesla employees.
I'll bet. Did you ever do anything that related to the film industry in the Noe Valley?
No.
Yeah. Digression.
Digression.
Some of the very, very first silent movies were made in the Noe Valley near there.
Silent Film Museum.
There you go.
They do.
That's right.
Entirely volunteer run, but that's a great little organization.
Yep.
Well, you know, we were talking about our little radio station being unique among radio stations. Well, I can assume that our little Vashon Heritage Museum is unique as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how it differs? Or
yeah, I mean, it's an incredible museum for the size and the fact that, you know, I'm the only full-time employee. Marissa Zaniff is a part-time employee, but it's incredible for a couple reasons. When Knut Berger came to give his talk, he said he thought it was maybe the best small community museum he'd seen, and he visits these all the time. And then when For Culture came, they said that our volunteer corps was absolutely one of the most impressive they've ever seen.
Wow.
And, you know, there are lots of things that make the museum unique and special. The history is unique, but I think really it's the volunteers and just the incredible passion and talent that we have is just, it's unparalleled. I mean, people have incredible expertise that they bring, and then they just really put in an immense amount of time to bring it up to have really high standards. So
let's divert back for a minute to your education. I mean, you grew up in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
right? And part of the Simpson family, right?
Yeah.
So your family's history goes back into the origins of Seattle.
Right? Yeah, that's true with the C.D. Stimson Company and the Stimson Marina, which is still in Ballard now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. So what drove you away from Seattle and to Hawaii to go to school? Other than the weather.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's pretty obvious.
Yeah. Well, I always wanted to study archaeology, and I liked the idea of Pacific archaeology. And then also there's some family connection as well. My grandma is from Hawaii. I still had a little bit of family there. My mom was born there, so yeah.
So you did some archaeology in the South Pacific, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did an archaeological excavation in Guam.
Mm.
And that was just an incredible experience. We got to work with Chamorro cultural practitioners, the local people mm-hmm. there, and we got to look at an indigenous site and then also a Spanish colonial era site. So that was really, really fun.
Well, I have to admit, we have a connection. First of all, I lived in Ballard for, I don't know, 10 or 12 years. And then I have a degree in anthropology, specifically in archaeology. And my brother was an archaeologist. And I worked with him on a dig site in eastern Montana. In fact, he was digging that site for his master's degree. And I actually found the thing that proved his thesis. So.
Really?
Yeah, wow. I thought that was pretty cool.
You contributed to history.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. Anyway,
what did you find? Cool.
His premise was that in years past, they always thought that they had bison jumps, you know, where they run the bison off a cliff, that they only held them in the fall in preparation for winter. And he said, why that? I mean, surely they could do it any time. And indeed, I found a fully articulated cow with a calf in utero. So that proved his theory that there was and she had a projectile points in her as well. So it was obvious that she had been butchered there.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, that proved his thesis. So anyway, it's kind of fun.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good brother.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fascinating to say
the
least.
Yeah. Truman.
Yeah.
Truman, that reminds me of a head smashed in buffalo jump.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's up in Canada. So if you have the opportunity, it's a tremendous exhibit and goes into a lot of that history. Not in the same place that you were, of course, similar techniques of harvesting
bison. And this cliff was only about 20 feet tall. I mean, it was very. I mean, most of the bison jumps are really big. I mean, they drop 100 feet or something. Mm-hmm. This one was just a very small one, but fascinating.
Kevin, what was the name of that?
Head smashed in buffalo jump. It's very descriptive.
quite the attractive name.
Exactly. Yeah. Very descriptive.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The culture was that you were to not allow any of the buffalo that went over the jump to survive.
Right.
Because the concern was that they would then spread the word as they got back to the herd, they would spread the word that this is what would happen if you ran in that direction. It was quite fascinating with the archaeological work they had done to see where they had set up basically blinds. Yep. So while I don't know that they had horses that they could actually herd the buffalo, they were able to scare them and channel their route over the cliff. So
yeah, it's a big Y. You've got stone piles and a big Y that they would hide behind and then jump up and frighten them as they moved on.
They didn't compress the buffalo as they went through the chutes, did they?
No.
I'm not sure. They had to have directed them over the cliff.
Grant Hoosie, the famous woman who came up with that to calm the cattle down.
Graham.
Granville?
Yep.
I shouldn't bring up a subject unless I
can. No, that's right.
You need to write it down before you ask it, right? That's right. I'm like, come on.
Well, let's switch over.
Let's get back to
Greta's sort of journey to get here. You went to the University of Hawaii. You were an archaeologist. You did digs in the South Pacific. And then you gave that all up to go to Britain, to go to university, to become a museum person. Yeah, so how did that happen?
That's definitely related. I really loved the material culture part of archaeology, you know, seeing how people lived through their things. There's a, as you well know, so often in written historical record, it's very, very particular people whose records we've kept. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea that in archaeology, a lot of people who didn't necessarily keep written records, whose narratives weren't privileged, their fingerprints are still all over the physical record. And so I really love that. I love the stories that physical objects can tell. But I figured out from the dig in Guam that I was not made for the dig lifestyle.
Yeah.
It was a fun one time, but I didn't want to do that
I'm with
the
you
time.
There 100%. Yeah.
Not for me. No. Somebody else can dig them up, and I would rather look
you
at them.
You can interpret them, right?
Once they're in the museum.
There you go.
So that's kind of what led me.
but what got you to Leicester?
Oh, well, I had done a study abroad in England before Leicester, very first ever museum school. The oldest one.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so it has a good reputation and ended up going there. it was a lot of fun. I was there right, and it was a very exciting time to be there too, because I was there when they discovered Richard III in the parking lot.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I got to be there for that whole journey from digging him up to building the new I guess, not burial, but the memorial. Oh, yeah, and that was very exciting.
Fantastic. That was.
There was all this debate between Leicester and York about who should get the body. Oh, it was very contentious. Everyone had strong opinions. It was a very exciting time to be in Leicester.
Sounds like Vashon. Yeah. Well, nobody on Vashon has strong opinions.
No, it's good training. It was good training for being here. Yeah.
Really? Let me ask you a question. Bruce, in the introduction, said that you've been working on this special exhibit, An Island Revered, Honor and Friendship, the Shobabs and the Sherman Family Collection. Can you tell us what that special exhibit's all about?
Yeah, so it is about the Shobabs, the indigenous people of Vashon. It's about their life ways and culture, but it's also, acknowledges the provenance of the items we have on display, which is that they were all collected and cared for and preserved by the Sherman family. This is Jim Sherman's collection. And so we worked with both Jim and the Puyallup, Brandon Raynon, his head of historic preservation for the Puyallup, and they co-curated the exhibit, and it was just a really fascinating collaboration. It's one of those things where your job is really getting them in the room together, and then you just stand back. Get out of the way and kind of gather up what they have to say. And it was just an incredible collaboration. I think, you know, both people went in wanting to make sure that their perspectives and that they were understood and nobody was misrepresented, and they met and just immediately got along and found that they really wanted to tell the same story.
What did you learn about the relationship between the white settler and the Shobab?
Well, this is a really unique situation because by the time the Sherman family got there in the 1870s, the village sites of the Shobab there wasn't much there anymore, but there were people who had come back, and they had a pretty good relationship with them. I actually wrote a quote down from Gene Sherman. He said, "My father and his younger brother, 7 and 9-year-old kids, stayed through the summer by themselves, and the folks went back to Tacoma. But the Indians were still there, and they kind of looked out for the kids." So they had a pretty close relationship in that way. And then there are these two little woven baskets made by Mary Squally Bridges, coiled baskets. And when Brandon Raynon saw those, he said, you know, if you want to show that this was a situation of friendship, this particular instance, put those baskets first. Because anyone who comes in and knows that if she gave those baskets to your family, you were friends. And there wasn't an antagonistic relationship there. So that was really important to both of them, that it be clear that though, you know, the history of exploitation and disenfranchisement of the Shobabs and the Puyallup is real and really important and highlighted, that this particular instance was a really great story of friendship.
And again, the dates of this relationship?
Well, so that was early on late 1800s, but the Shermans, you know, they still live here, so that they found these things. Some of those things were gifted to them, and then some of the things they found all the way up through present day. There's an incredible feast bowl on display that Jim's son found, and then Jim worked, he got a recommendation for an expert preservationist, conservator, that he worked with, recommended by the Burke Museum, to preserve this feast bowl, and it's really spectacular. Brendan was really excited when he saw it.
And what is it made of? Is it wood?
It's wood.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it was an interesting find. The Sherman family, Jim's family, lives up above Quartermaster Harbor, and there's a little creek there. And one day his son was walking down the driveway and saw this stick, what he thought was a stick, coming out of one of the clay banks. And so he went over and sort of looked at it and realized it wasn't a stick and dug it out. Mm-hmm. And it's this incredible feast bowl that's what, probably 12, 14 inches long, wow. Six, 7 inches wide, hand-carved out of wood. And Jim worked with the Burke, to preserve it in glycol and dry it out, and I mean all that sort of stuff to preserve it. And it's just so it's on display.
Is it?
And it's worth seeing.
I mean, now I'm really curious. Is it cedar or what? What is the?
I believe it is.
I believe cedar.
Yeah. I would think it would be.
Although they used the native people of Vashon Island use other woods, yew particularly for arrows and bows and that kind of thing.
And one cool interaction, so the bows that are on display are made of yew, and Jim had harvested some yew off his property with the intention of maybe trying to make something, and he realized he wasn't going to get around to it, so he offered it to Brandon Raynon, and who was so excited to take back this beautifully prepared and harvested yew, and he took it back to the Puyallup's, I forget his title, but the carver, who's going to make some bows out of it.
Oh, so fantastic.
That's pretty
cool. Fantastic.
That's great.
Yeah. Kevin?
I think I live near where that bowl might have been discovered.
Oh, yeah.
Go check. But, you know, I just recently read a book about Vancouver Islanders here, and they talked about some of the relationships with the indigenous tribes. And they go back to the history of the potlatch on Village Island, where they basically arrested people and took away the potlatch artifacts, you know, the things that the native Canadians used in their potlatch ceremony. And then many of them are dispersed around the world in different museums, and the struggle now to basically repatriate those artifacts to places like the Yumista Cultural Center and the New Yambalese Cultural Center on Quadra Island. So this relationship between museums and indigenous tribes and artifacts, I suspect you've worked very closely with the Puyallup tribe around these issues. Can you tell us a little bit about that relationship and what it means to be a museum in this time of respecting these elements of this culture when their ancestors are still here with us?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my gosh, there's so many things. Where to start? Where to start? Yeah, so specifically the Vashon Heritage Museum is in a great position. We work really closely with the Puyallup tribe, and we really, really prioritize letting them tell their own stories. And it's great because in this exhibit, Jim was on the same page. He said, you know, the story is not about my family. My family is part of the provenance of these things, but it's not about us. And so Brandon really... It is his words, and Lori Tucker is kind of has worked basically as our liaison, and she's very good about making sure we're working with Amber Hayward, who's the linguistics expert, to make sure all the language is correct, and that it's all very respectful, and everything in there is as the tribe would want it. So that's specific to us. And then, generally, of course, that the relationship between museums and Indigenous people all over the world is, it is a history of colonialism, and it is a very contentious subject. That work is ongoing. I think some really interesting institutions to look at. If you're looking at the far side, I think the Museum of Us, previously the Museum of Man in San Diego, is a really good example to look at of their decolonizing efforts. I've spoken to their head of decolonization. They have actually a position that's working at their museum to do that work. And sometimes that means repatriation. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it means something else. So they're kind of on the really... I mean, radical sounds bad, but it's good. The work they're doing is good, but they're kind of on the really radical end of that. And then you see, you know, maybe smaller efforts in other museums around the world. And then, some places that are doing a lot less. Our education department is putting together some boxes that can go to schools as kind of curriculums in a curricula in a box. And, we've been pulling some children's books to put in those. And one book I just read, which I will recommend to your listeners, is a middle grade book called Written in Stone. And it's from the perspective of a Macaw girl and specifically deals with the issue of the potlatch and somebody who's come to take the artifacts from it. So for younger listeners or somebody who just wants to dive in but doesn't want to read a big, heavy book, it's really good.
You know, I had a chance to... participate in a potlatch of the macaw at the time they were deciding whether to resume whaling. So the culture runs so deep, you know, it's just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate, Greta, what you're saying, that basically the opportunity of the museum to be an advocate to help tell the story in the way that the Puyallup tribe would want that story told. So helping to amplify their voice sounds really spectacular. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
If you go to the National Museum in London, you're going to see Egypt and Greece and, you know, all over the world where they've robbed basically these. And it always fascinated me. I thought, well, you know, this is really interesting, but gee whiz. I mean, the Elgin Marble, you know, is a perfect.
Still fighting over the
Elgin
Marble.
You're still fighting over that, yeah. So that sort of stuff goes on and on. I really appreciate what you folks are doing.
Well, and the Benin bronzes are in the news, it feels like, every week.
Exactly.
A lot of museums in Britain have started efforts to give them back. A museum where I worked for a little while, the Horniman, has given back their Benin bronzes. But then, of course, the British Museum, it's actually written into British law that they can't.
Right.
So they would need Parliament to change that. Which...
You know, one of the artifacts that they said was now at the, I think it might have been the UMISTA Cultural Center. Mm. It's a chief's chair, if I remember right. It had been in the British Museum for over a century. And I think it is now officially on loan back to the Cultural Center because they're not allowed to give it away.
That's a good way to finesse it.
It's such an interesting thing, all these histories of conflict and how that affects museums. So at Iolani Palace, too, you go in there and there's almost no furniture because when the overthrow happened, all the furniture was taken out, and it's gone to private collectors. And so they're always asking, even on the tours, like, if you know anybody who has any of this stuff, encourage them to please donate it back.
Wow.
So terms like decolonization and what we're talking about in this respect for indigenous cultures, I mean, we're running into a brick wall of wokeism here politically in the United States right now. How is the Heritage Museum going to sort of navigate through that?
I think that
I was going to say that one.
We got 3 minutes. Yeah,
that was a loaded question. Right.
I think that the museum is committed to its work to be multivocal and to tell narratives from a variety of perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't think it has to be labeled woke or traditional or anything. It's just everyone benefits when you hear more perspectives and more stories.
Well, I think by including the indigenous people, I mean, it's a way for them to celebrate their culture as well and share it with, you know, the rest of the world. And so I think if it's done respectfully, like you folks are doing, I think it's a good thing. I mean, to have those objects out there to promote that culture. I mean, it answers a bunch of questions to me.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So, So we're getting down to the last couple minutes here. So if anybody wants to visit the special exhibit, An Island Revered, how would they do that? And what's the best way to see it?
Yes, please come visit. Well, we are open every day, Wednesday through Sunday, 1 to 4. And then on Saturdays during the summer, we have extended hours this year. So from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And this exhibit will be on display through January. But don't wait. Come see it now. And we have some fun stuff planned for September. We're going to do an artifact identification day where if you've found something and you'd like to see if it's what it might be, you can bring that along. So I think that's September 13th. I won't give an exact date. I don't have my calendar in front of me. But please come on by. We would love to see you at the museum.
Is the museum doing anything for the Strawberry Festival?
Yes. Thank you for asking. We're doing the ice cream social, which we do every year. That's in our back garden, and that will be on the 18th from 6 to 8. Come get some free ice cream, listen to the Lazy Dog String Band, and Yeah, and enjoy some time with your family.
And see the hydroplane.
And see the hydroplane, exactly. There's a lot.
And the Garden of the Ancients.
And the Garden of the Ancients. Of good
stuff back there.
And so, we'll have the museum open a little bit late, too, so you can come and see the exhibit during the Strawberry
Festival. We got to let the staff go home. Can't be too late. What's late at the museum?
Yeah. Well, I think we'll have it open until 7.
Close to Vashon midnight.
Yeah. I like that. Vashon midnight.
Thank you. Well, and thank you for coming, Greta, and thanks for talking about the museum and the special exhibit. Next week is a Truman Show, so you'll get us to hear us talk about current events. So for Amy in absentia, for Truman, Craig, Kevin, and Greta, I'm Bruce Holman. Thanks for spending an hour with us, and thanks for listening to KVSH 101.9 FM, The Voice of Vashon, also streaming live at voiceofvashon.org. Thank you.